Hey guys, and welcome back to the Love That Lasts podcast. And today, the Studleys are back with the Anatomy of Marriage miniseries bonus sex episode titled, It's Complicated. And in this episode, Melanie continues to talk about the complex world of sex and explores why intimacy and sexuality are such hard topics to talk about. And she also explores how we can view sexuality as a banquet instead of just a bowl of cereal. Enjoy.
Our show is supported by 31 Creative Ways. Jeff and I wrote this. It's a really cool book for him and for her, and it's a way to bring back beauty, joy, and vibrancy to your relationship. We wrote this book for him and her. Each day covers a topic or theme that is crucial to a healthy relationship and includes a challenge to put that theme into action, as well as providing a section at the end of each day to record your thoughts, memories, and fun details. To find out more, visit 31creativeways.com.
This episode is going to cover a lot of different things in regards to sexuality. Some is the way we learn about it, some is the way we actually approach it, and some is healing from sexual abuse. There will be really heavy stories in this, and I will warn you when those are about to play, so that if you are triggered by these things, you can totally turn the episode off. Without further ado, let's dive right in.
My favorite thing, sexually or not, that you do is to touch my hair, and you don't ever do it.
Well, there's a... Okay, so...
So there's a million reasons that you won't, or...
In therapy, I talk about, like, things are systemic. That means, like, everything is connected.
So this is an actual argument that we got in one night and recorded, and yes, it sucked as bad as it sounds like it sucked. And the gist of what Seth is saying is that he knows what I like, but he chooses not to do it. And here's why.
More often than not, it's the wrong timing.
Well, okay.
What? It's either too cold, it's everything. The chances of me doing the right thing are so slim.
Just listening back to that conversation really annoys me. But it shows me something. It is so, so hard to talk about intimacy. It's hard to talk about what you want, what you expect, all of those things. And I can't even play you more of the argument because it just goes round and round in these weird circles that don't feel particularly related. And even that's annoying. Let's talk to Les and Leslie Parrott about why they think that is.
So just how hard it is for couples to feel comfortable talking about things that are intensely private and loaded and emotional and also fragile sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how brave you have to be to find a way through that.
Yeah, and the research says that really if you want a fulfilling love life, it's not about, you know, just the physical aspect of it, of course. That's the passionate side of love, right? Sternberg did a tremendous gift for the professional community at Yale years ago, about 15 years ago, when he did this massive study on love and said that you can break it down into three ingredients. Passion is that biological side. That's what gets two people together in the first place. It's
the chemistry.
It's what draws you. And that will soon fade. It's guaranteed. That's not going to be at a 10 out of 10 every day of the week, every week out of the year, all your married life long. It just doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, there's also intimacy, which is the emotional side of love. And that's that part of love that draws you together, that increases over time because you have a shared history.
You're attached. You feel safe. You're completely, don't have to edit your thoughts. You're known. You can trust.
You get me and I get you like nobody else on the planet. And, we're reading off the same sheet of music here. Even when nobody else hears the song, we got this. And then, of course, there's commitment, and that's the willful part of love. That's the part that is truly a decision. It's the part that says, in spite of all the uncertainty and unpredictability in our lives, I'm going to make this relationship rock solid. That doesn't come from your hormones. It doesn't come from your emotions. It comes from your will. Mm-hmm. And so if you think of those as the hot, warm, and cold ingredients of love, passion, intimacy, and commitment, and you don't put all your money on passion, it begins to balance things out so you don't have this crazy expectation about what things should be happening in the bedroom because it's much more than that, right? Our friend Kevin Lehman says sex begins in the kitchen, and it's so true. This is not just an isolated thing that we do however many times we do that. It's a way of living that cultivates that and brings out that natural expectation and expression.
Yeah, and I love that point because it's often less the conversation and more just the dance together. You said, the cherishing moment earlier in the day that leads to the relaxed shared experience later. Mm-hmm. And so it's just knowing that there's an ebb and flow to intimacy, and there's an ebb and flow to passion, and letting the commitment hold you. And then you don't feel anxious or guilty when there's that ebb, because you realize, well, that's what commitment is. And when we stay committed and we keep coming back, then it flows back in.
I was struck by that idea that love has three different ingredients. I had never really thought of it in that particular way before. So when Dr. Les Parrott said that, it made me realize that I have been trying to make chocolate chip cookies for like 12 years without all the ingredients. And messed up chocolate chip cookies are one thing, but flying a plane, now that's another. I'll let Dr. Tina Shermer-Sellers clarify.
Let's take flying a plane. Pretty complex thing, right? We wouldn't expect anybody to be able to fly a plane without any instruction and, you know, supervision, all of that. We wouldn't hand them, you know, keys or whatever, say, go fly a plane. Yeah. And yet we expect people to be able to navigate all the emotional intelligence and physical intelligence and sexual intelligence, mm-hmm. and all of the relational intelligence that goes into that. And
nope, that's not your phone. It's hers.
No, you know, we wouldn't expect someone to be able to do that. And yeah. We totally expect people to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And we give them absolutely nothing to be able to navigate that in relationships. Yeah.
That's true. And like, as I hear you talk, is, you know, not only you're trying to navigate what you're feeling emotionally, you know, what barriers you need to let down or which ones are safe to still hold, right? You're also responsible for, to some degree, or at least feel responsible for the other person's, you know, are they enjoying this? Is this okay? Is this, you have some empathy and like understanding towards your partner, of course. So it's almost like both of you are responsible for your emotional wellness and the other person's simultaneously. And that's like, that's huge. That's
exactly.
That's a ton. So no wonder it can go sideways so often.
So now we're not only baking cookies without enough ingredients, we don't even know how to turn on the oven / fly a plane. That's how I got there. But anyway, it just showed me how much we actually don't know about intimacy and relationships and sexuality and all of that stuff. So I asked Dr. Tina what her dream sex ed would be for people. And here's what she said.
Sex education would begin, it would begin at 2, and it would follow the children. So what are children interested in? What are they starting to look at, talk about? Well, they're discovering their body, you know, and they're finding things and they're wanting things labeled. Well, you're labeling them, their noses, their ears, their eyes. You're helping them label their bodies as well as you help them label their world. Mm-hmm. And you're giving them the names of all parts of their body, right? Not funny names. You're giving them the real names. Right. And maybe you're getting the picture books out and they're the whole body and you're showing them. And maybe you're showing them what the insides of their bodies look like too. And the genitals are all part of it, just like the kidneys and everything, right? And it's all, and in my world, I think the body is an amazing thing. And so I talk about it that way, like, wow, isn't this an amazing, wonderful thing? And we take care of it. Because it's a wonderful thing. And that's why we learn to brush our teeth and, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. And when they hit 4 and 5 and they become curious about other people's bodies. And so then you help them learn about other people's bodies. And that's when doctor play happens and you expect that that's going to happen. And so you don't shame them when it does. It's like, well, of course, yes, your brother's different than you are. Your sister's different than you are. Your mom or your dad is different than you are, or however it goes. And so there are, we know, because we have plenty of books, that there are very particular curiosities that show up at very particular ages. We know when they're coming. We plan for them. We know when they're going to walk in on their parents. We know that's going to happen. We know how we're going to respond. We plan for it. And so that kids are developmentally on time and we are just ready for it when it happens, or we're we're preparing them if it's going to be something like when their body starts changing. If boys are going to start having wet dreams at 9 or 10, we're letting them know, hey, your body's starting to change. It's going to start to change. These things are going to happen. We want you to know that it's going to happen so you're not surprised and so you know you're not wetting the bed. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing. Your body's getting ready. But your body's going to change over like an 8-year span. Yeah. It's going to take a lot of time because a lot of really important things are going on. So we're telling them ahead of time. Mm-hmm. We're letting them know. And we're helping them know the bigger picture of what's happening too. But not just what's happening physiologically, but also what's changing relationally and culturally in their world, right? That things are changing in their social group too. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important now with the digital world that we're helping kids know how to navigate that mm-hmm. as well. That there's a lot of really big things that they're having to manage. And we're helping them know, like, here's some things that you're going to be exposed to visually. And here's how we're going to want you to probably manage that because it's going to be a lot to have to manage. Mm-hmm. So it's staying ahead of them.
So as I was editing this last part, this line stood out to me.
Staying ahead of them.
And I realized, like, that's one of the biggest problems. Our sex education generally doesn't stay ahead of us. It's typically behind us. By the time you're learning about what things actually are, you've already experienced some of it. And you're making interpretations of that experience without actual knowledge, which is not super great. And it's one thing when you're like 10 and learning about wet dreams after you've had them, but it's a totally different thing when you're like 26 and learning about sex after you're already married.
I had these fantasies of this romantic Hollywood sort of picture.
This is our friend from episode 4.
This like big fluffy down-filled bed and the curtains are flowing and it's like white curtains and, you know, the sun is beaming in and you're kissing, right? So I had these like ideals in my mind of what it was going to be like. So like the first week we were married during our honeymoon, you know, the first night I'm feeling really uncomfortable. It's really painful. I'm not enjoying it at all. I'm trying really hard to enjoy it. And my husband is being really kind and patient towards me, being like, we don't need to do this. We can wait. Like, we can take our time. And I think I was just really stubborn and gung-ho. Like, I just wanted everything to be magical and perfect and forced it, and it just was not pleasant.
It's not all about intercourse, or it's not all about this. I just want to start with holding and touching. Like, right. It doesn't have to just be this or that behavior.
Yeah.
People make it all about one behavior or mm-hmm. another behavior. They make it all about intercourse. People come into my office all the time and say, we haven't had sex in a long time. And I'll jokingly say, well, what kind of sex haven't you had? You know, mm-hmm. because it's all been reduced to the vernacular of intercourse.
Tina, shut the front door. You're telling me that sex is more than just intercourse? Lady, we're going to figure out exactly what Tina means after a quick word from our sponsors.
Hey guys, just want to take a little break to talk about something very, very, very important to Alyssa and I, and that is Compassion International. We sponsor multiple kids with Compassion, one even with Kinsley's exact birthday, which is really fun. And if you know Compassion, and they're incredible, they're amazing, they basically, for $38 a month, give a kid in poverty-stricken areas, third world countries, the stuff they need, you know, water, food, schooling, medical, and on top of that, they even give them the gospel and church community and Jesus, which not many child sponsorship programs do, and that's why we actually love Compassion. High integrity of a company, you know, not even close to a stain on their record in regards to how they approach the nonprofit world. They're above reproach. They serve these kids. They have people all in the field. It's amazing. So what we want to do is we're trying to get 1,000 kids sponsored during the holidays, and we want to send you a free signed copy of Love That Lasts if you go ahead and sponsor a kid. Or if you want to sponsor 5, then you get 5 signed copies of Love That Lasts. So go to compassion.com/Jeff and Alyssa. compassion.com/Jeff and Alyssa. We'd love if you guys can come alongside us and help out. We want to go for 1,000. I think we've been doing this for just a couple weeks and we've already got over 200. So we're a fifth of the way, you guys. Let's do it. We need your help and we'd love if you guys can support.
What if you thought of sexuality and touch and loving touch as a banquet?
Okay, gotta cut you off right there. So I don't know about you guys, but I don't go to very many banquets, but I do go to the grocery store. So I'm going to infuse this next clip with some grocery store analogies to help it make more sense to all of us non-banquet attending people in the world. So let's start over.
What if you thought of sexuality and touch and loving touch as a banquet?
Or Fred Meyer / Kroger / Target.
And that it wasn't about intercourse.
Chicken cutlets.
And it wasn't about a goal.
Rotini noodles.
And it wasn't about orgasm.
Pesto.
But it was about connection and pleasure.
Sampling brie cheese on a crusty cracker with jam. Or finding your favorite Vans on clearance. You know the ones I'm talking about, with a zipper on the back.
And that every time you decided to touch, what made it successful, quote unquote, was that connection and pleasure happened.
You sample all the samples, stroll those aisles, read those labels, say hi to the lady at the deli and the man in the produce aisle. Connection. Pleasure.
That's all.
That is all.
So whether you had 5 minutes or you had 5 hours.
5 hours? That is a long time to shop at a grocery store, Tina.
Connection and pleasure was what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And you had a banquet, right? And so it wasn't going to be cereal every time.
Yeah.
But it was, what did you feel like? What did you want? And connection and pleasure. So that way, it was different all the time, and it was whatever you had the energy for. So sometimes in your marriage, you might be sick.
Ice cream.
Or maybe there are babies.
Potato salad from the deli.
Whatever. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have lots of time, and sometimes you have no time, and sometimes somebody feels wild, and it feels crazy. And
chicken dippers.
Sometimes you feel tender and
nachos.
But you know connection and pleasure is going to happen. Mm-hmm. But you're not stuck on it is going to be this behavior all the time, mm-hmm, or this thing all the time. Because if you make it the same thing all the time, it'll fall to the law of diminishing returns. And I don't care how much you like one thing, if you do that one thing every single time, someone is going to get bored.
Yeah.
And desire is going to fade.
So the reason I created the grocery store analogy was because when Tina talked about the banquet and the idea of eating the same thing over and over again, and how sex is reduced to just intercourse, the first thing that popped into my head was what it felt like for me when I was newly married and I would go to the grocery store. I used to spend a really long time at the grocery store looking up and down the aisles and thinking, oh, what can I make for supper tonight? This is so much fun. I'm a grown-up. But now I've got 3 kids and a dog and I don't give 2 craps about going to the grocery store. But y'all, that's all on me. My attitude about the grocery store is what makes it boring and bad. But if I change my attitude to look for connection and pleasure, I guarantee that I can have a whole new set of eyes for old Fred Meyer, and I could probably enjoy myself.
One of the lines I like to use with my wife every so often, because you know you can't use them too much. You gotta pace yourself.
This is Dr. Corey Allen again. You'll remember him from last episode.
I'm saying that because she's sitting right here shaking her head at me. Is the whole, hey, are you interested in some moderate to mediocre level sex tonight? You know, because it's just like, I want to have sex with you and I want to hang out, but I can't promise a lot, you know, because I'm tired. It's been a long day for both of us. We're exhausted, but hey, let's celebrate. Let's have some tender loving kind of moments. And so that's what I love, is when couples will empower that area of their life by just naming and claiming. Because a lot of times, if you can get on the same page and say, yeah, I can't go 5-star with you, but I could do 3.5. I could do 3, you know, because then he's like, your husband could be fine.
Yeah.
I'm totally on board with that. And maybe then it evolves to 5. But if it doesn't, so what? You know, because it's like, hey, this is a process. This is a language.
On his podcast, Sexy Marriage Radio, Dr. Corey Allen talks a lot about low desire and high desire sexual partners. I'll let him explain more about it.
Because I think a lot of the time, if you're talking about sex, the low desire just feels, you know, just get your paws off me. You know, it's just, I have what you want and I know that. And therefore, that's where I love it, because Schnarch said at a talk one time, he said it would have been a whole lot easier if God just gave women 2 vaginas, because then they could have just given one to their husband and kept one to themselves and you're not fighting over it anymore. And it's like, yeah, I could see that. But it didn't happen that way.
What about the high desire partner?
The culmination of great sex is a true, both people being full-on willing, engaged participants, giving and taking and sharing and enjoying all of it. And it's just kind of a free flow of it. When it turns into obligation, subligation, all that kind of stuff where it just gets messy, it's not good for either one. because that's where you get into this whole concept of the high desire partner is seeking bad sex.
Yeah.
And it's like, hold on. Why do you keep seeking something that she's not even remotely interested in? And it's not saying don't seek it.
Yeah.
It's just saying, let's figure out a different way. Let's figure out something that's to where it's a collaborative kind of a thing where you both are willing participants and you both are engaged. My wife was very easy to read me anytime I was hovering. She knew exactly what was going on. And she's like, and so when she finally says, you're hovering, that's like, okay, thank you. I recognize that's not attractive. That's not helping invite this to happen. It's becoming needy. And if you got kids, you don't want to be needed because you know what that's like. It's like, yeah. get off me, you know, give me some space. So last thing you want is a husband or a wife assuming that role. So this is just a more empowering kind of a grown-up stance.
So we've learned a lot about sexuality and intimacy. Tina brought up the banquet idea, or grocery store idea, and that sex is not just one single act, but rather it's a way of interacting with your partner that can take many different forms, just like you can buy anything from earrings to potato chips at the grocery store. So why limit ourselves, right? While Dr. Corey is talking about the idea of sex as a language and that it doesn't always have to sound the same to still have meaning, much like poetry is written differently than a novel, or the way that jazz is different than an Italian aria. And one of the biggest things that I'm learning from this episode is that sexuality and intimacy are on a biopsychosocial spiritual dynamic continuum, which is just a really fancy way of saying that as you change and grow in these different areas, so does your sexuality and intimacy. And stick with me because this might seem weird at first, but let's start with biology. Think about it. If you have an emergency appendectomy, does that change the way that you connect physically with your spouse? Of course it does. A sick and healing body cannot be touched the same way that a perfectly healthy body can. What about the psychological aspects? If you are depressed, do you have the same type of intimate connection with your spouse? I don't think so. So our sexuality and intimacy is ever evolving, whether we like it or not. But unfortunately, we tend to have a static understanding about our sexuality and intimacy and believe that it does not change over the years or with our circumstances. And that sets us up to be frustrated and confused. A good example of how much we don't viscerally understand this idea as a culture is the fact that when you give birth to a baby, the doctors and nurses actually have to tell couples not to have sex for 6 weeks because the mother has to heal from childbirth. This should be so obvious and something that everyone understands, but it isn't, partially because of the culture of fear around openly talking about our bodies and the hypersexualization of certain parts of our bodies. And when we have completely ignored the biopsychosocial spiritual aspect of our own bodies, we end up with a society that does not understand the concept of having to heal from childbirth, or even the enormous change your body goes through after giving birth. Things like nursing. Nursing a baby changes how your body functions for a time, and usually how it looks for the rest of your life. And when we don't understand this, we approach our bodies, sexuality, and intimacy from such a one-dimensional, surfacey level place, and it only hurts everyone involved. If you can't look at your partner through a biopsychosocial spiritual lens, you may be unintentionally hurting them by ignoring things such as physical illness, past trauma, etc. So our sexuality and intimacy changes and grows as we change and grow, and it evolves with the situations that we live through. It isn't static or still. It's dynamic, and so we need to learn to be flexible and dynamic as well. So here's the part of the episode where we talk about the cleanup, as Dr. Tina called it in the first sex episode. But we're going to take it a step farther than just healing from misinformation about sexuality, but we're actually going to explore what it's like to heal from sexual trauma, both from the perspective of the victim and from the perspective of a parent of the victim. Now, these are super heavy stories. Their content is not graphic in nature, but they are still heart-wrenching and can put you in a very bad place if you're not careful. I do feel very strongly that this content and these stories are super important, and I want you to listen to them, but if you are triggered by these topics, please feel free to turn off the show. It's okay.
If we stripped away everything that we have in the culture that we're born into now, and you strip away all of our kind of knowledges that we have, and we're left just with us and the stars, the power of the sexual experience and the bond that it can create in that moment leaves people in awe,
right?
Often, And in the very earliest days when people were drawing on the caves, they drew spiritual and sexual together. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is that, it's awe-inspiring. Mm-hmm. There is something about the sexual and the spiritual that are together. And we know that too on the underbelly of it, because when you hurt someone sexually, you hurt them in their soul.
My disposition coming into it was I wanted to read books together. I wanted to...
Here's our friend again.
...have conversations about it and, like, get to a point where we felt really comfortable. But my husband didn't feel comfortable talking about it. Mm. And I think part of that is the family upbringing that we grew up in, where I had dealt with this history of abuse. And in the last few years... before we had gotten married, I had gone through counseling and talked to people about those experiences. And I felt more comfortable talking about intimacy than he did. And I think still to this day, it's just a thing that it's hard to talk to people about things when they don't feel comfortable crossing that barrier. And it is something that's still, I mean, it's still hard to talk about. The Bible says how you become one flesh. I think it's so true. You affect each other so profoundly. And his discomfort has become my discomfort to a level. And I feel a lot of the things I think that he feels, and vice versa.
As I stepped into the parts of this story that have trauma and abuse, I noticed a pattern of disabling discomfort. And I hadn't really expected it. I know that there is shame associated with abuse, but it had never occurred to me that the sheer discomfort of speaking things of this nature was strong enough that people would actually risk harm to others so that they didn't have to be uncomfortable in the moment. Our next story starts exactly at that point, where someone knows something that could have stopped the sexual abuse of a 7-year-old child, but chose not to tell anyone out of sheer discomfort or fear. Colleen offered to share her story with us in hopes that it will help both the victims of sexual abuse and the family members of the victims. We altered her voice to protect her family, for obvious reasons. Here's her story.
The one thing that just irked me to no end was being at my mother's funeral and having his sister-in-law come up to me and say, "Yeah, he's done this to other people." And I wanted to strangle her. I could not even believe my ears. It's like, you knew about this. You knew who I was. I mean, there was ways she could have figured out how to get a hold of me, you know, and this, it could have not happened. And that just, the people can know something like that and not say anything. It's just heart-wrenching to think, oh, well, my child just went through that for, because you were too lazy to say something.
I asked Colleen what it felt like when her daughter told her that she was being abused.
I think I went into like a state of shock, because I remember, I don't think she told me until it was like 10 o'clock at night or something. And I just, that whole night, I felt like I couldn't even close my eyes. Your brain just starts going over every single thing, every second she was with the person, and it was horrible.
Colleen remembers the way that her happy-go-lucky daughter began to change after the incidents.
She was pretty emotional, and it took her a long time to get through stuff. I had to, you know, every single night sit with her, and, you know, she would have to talk about what happened. And after a while, I sort of put like a time limit. I go, we'll talk about this for like X number of minutes, and then we'll... You know, then I would tell her stories, and I would make up different stories about her being, you know, the super strong superhero type person, and little stories that were silly. And, you know, she liked that. So that helped. And she did have therapy and that too.
For me, Colleen's story represents so many different things all at one time. On top of dealing with her daughter's abuse, her own mother actually abandoned her, and within months, her father died. So in the span of a single year, she is grieving the loss of abandonment, the sexual abuse of her daughter, and the death of both of her parents. And some of her experiences were isolated from her husband, while others were shared. And all of this took an enormous toll on their marriage.
You have to function, and then you have to try to deal with, you know, your daughter being abused and what that's going to do to her life, and that just tears your heart out. Then your mother turns on you, and that is like unbelievable. And I think the worst thing that came out of that, oh well, I mean, for me, not the worst thing was obviously my daughter, but all I could think of was like, oh my God, if my own mother can't love me and help me through this, why would anybody want to love me? It's horrible. That was like torture. And it affected everything. It affected, you know, my marriage, and it's like, and then my dad died shortly after that, and he loved me, and I was his only daughter and the youngest, and you know, when he died, I just felt like the only person in the world who loved me just died, and it was terrible. It was just a bad place to be.
I asked Colleen if she thought that her husband understood what that was like for her.
I don't know. Yeah. He probably heard it enough. You know, because any hurt he would cause me, it'd just be like, you know, you don't love me, my own mother doesn't love me, so why would you? I'm not anything.
I'm so thankful to Colleen for sharing her story. When I started this episode, I was so focused on the victims themselves healing from sexual trauma that I completely ignored the fact that parents and family members also become victims when a tragedy like this happens. I told Colleen how much it meant to me that she was willing to step back into something so incredibly painful to potentially help others who are walking on that same path today. I also talked with Dr. Corey Allen about the mental toll that it takes on an individual when they are abused as a child. Here is what he had to say about it.
Obviously, it's going to taint everything just because you're talking about a traumatic episode. If you're looking at just the developmental stage of anywhere from 8, 9, 10 to 15, you got a whole lot of formative things going on, not only in your body with puberty, but your brain. A lot of the different things that could happen during that stage will dramatically impact in deep levels lifetime. Most people that I've ever come across in my practice that have had any kind of abuse, any kind of traumatic molestation kind of things, or just sexual trauma, they go down one of two paths. One is they go very, very promiscuous, and it's basically like they're trying to regain power once they get to where they're capable of seeking pleasure, seeking that. They just like they're trying to restore themselves through the avenue. The other is it's the complete shame and complete guilt, complete denial. And a lot of times the denial comes because they may at some point get a chance to confront their abuser, who then denies it, because if it's a family member, it gets very convoluted and conflicted. So when marriage comes into play, I'm a big believer that healing comes through the process, you know, of what caused damage can actually cause healing. But it takes a partner that's tremendously willing to understand that and be patient.
If you're not open in all areas of your marriage with your spouse, like, there's a wall that gets put up.
This is Allie, who you'll recognize from previous episodes. She made a really good point about the way that we sometimes unknowingly build walls around the topics that make us uncomfortable in our marriage.
And I definitely have put up a wall in that area because I'm just so uncomfortable by it.
Tina Shermer-Sellers also had some beautiful ideas around the fact that we tend to speak to our partners about intimacy and sexuality out of our hurt instead of out of our health.
That rather than being able to speak to how lonely they are and how much they miss each other and how just hurt they are, they're critical and they're speaking from these hurt places.
Yeah.
And this is what happens all the time. Mm-hmm. I think in part it's that we have set people up to not know how to be in conversation with each other around sexuality and intimacy in a way that really helps them find their way to each other so that they can say, you know, I miss you and I, I don't know how to.
So when I was editing this last bit of tape, something struck me between the conversation with Tina and Allie, because Allie goes on to share this.
But I think having kids has slowly started to erode the over-private mentality of things like that that I have. I've gotten really into birth since my last pregnancy. And like, it is unreal to me the amount of images that people see as a sexual image of a woman giving birth or a woman breastfeeding that I just, it infuriates me because I'm just like, no, like our bodies are doing something so incredible that God made us to do. Like, look at that and see that beauty versus mm-hmm. like saying like, she should be wearing a robe. Like a human is coming out of her. She should not be wearing a robe. Like, that is fine. And so I think for me, birth has been like the gateway for me. Like, it's kind of opened up. Like, I feel more comfortable with nakedness or bodies and things like that when I'm seeing it do what it's supposed to do mm-hmm. in that aspect.
How cool is that? So the same woman who in the last episode said that talking about sex was gross and inappropriate is now saying that she's getting more comfortable with nakedness and bodies just because birth is her gateway. So y'all, I think we just need to find our gateways, because sexuality and intimacy are in fact a part of our biopsychosocial spiritual makeup, and I am not talking Maybelline. So start with your gateway. Start with your healthiest. Oh crap, I forgot that I'm not supposed to tell you what to do. Scratch that. I will start with my gateway. I will start with my healthiest, which for me happens to be feminism, and I don't care if that rubs you the wrong way. When I think about equality for women, it puts my mind into a space that views my own body in a more holistic and beautiful way. So I'm going to start there. And it might be childbirth for you. It might be nursing. I mean, who knows? I don't know. But start there. Start where you're the healthiest and speak to your spouse from your place of health, not your place of hurt. Shoot. There I go again. Telling people what to do.
Guys, we really hope that you found these two episodes helpful and insightful. Sex and intimacy are very confusing topics, but hopefully the Studleys have helped shed a little light and bring some clarity to the conversation.
Our show is produced by Matt Carter, edited and sound designed by Melanie Studley. Special thanks to executive producer Craig Gross and StrongerMarriages.com.
Next week, Alyssa and I will be back to talk about faith, culture, and answer your questions. So have a great week. We love you guys.